When one considers the mass of humanity, it can be quite overwhelming, especially when we consider the different perspectives and faiths and opinions that so many people have about how life should be lived and what should be prioritized. Having all of these contradictory beliefs and values, conflict with people is inevitable. And world history bears this out. Years ago, with the help of an older man, many of whom you knew, Don Dell, experienced man, I decided to undertake the project of pouring a slab of concrete on my property as a parking spot for my van. Didn't have a garage at that time. And as preparations were made and the date for the pour approached, Don prepared me for reality. "Andy, there are two kinds of concrete. There's concrete that is cracked, and there's concrete that's going to crack." In other words, what he was telling me was that the environment and the various stresses which impact concrete would eventually lead to cracks. It was our job to prepare for them and control them to the best of our ability, but they were going to happen. Similarly, I would say the same thing about conflict. You are either in conflict with others or you will be. And while it is true that God created us for a relationship with Him and with others made in His image, it's also true that the introduction of sin into this world, as we read in Genesis chapter 3, has impacted not only our relationship with God, but with one another as well. And the curses which come with sin make life hard, turning order into chaos. Life gets messy, and our relationships become complicated. Think for just a moment about the best, most fulfilling relationship you have ever had with a human being. Got a person in mind? You had conflicts with that person. You had conflicts with that person. If you didn't, it wasn't a very deep relationship. It wasn't very meaningful. And I'm sorry. I'm not sorry that you have to have conflicts to have a meaningful relationship, but meaningful relationships go there. There's going to inevitably be some conflict, disagreements, disappointments. So, godly people, having personally experienced conflict in varying degrees throughout our lifetimes, we acknowledge the reality of conflict in this present world. We're not going to pretend like there's no conflict. That's not helpful. So let's consider what Jesus observed and taught about this reality, that there would be this conflict in the world. And with that, then, perhaps we'll be better able to consider what godly people should do in the face of conflict. Since it's a reality, since it's going to happen one time or another, and then most likely multiple times, let's prepare for it. And we'll do that in a second lesson. But do you have a plan for dealing with the reality of conflict in your life? You have a plan? Where one's heart is truly at, his spiritual state is oftentimes revealed in the heat and stress of conflict. And if you don't like the way that you've acted at times in the face of conflict, and I know there are plenty of them that I can come to mind in my own history, Those reveal my weaknesses. Those reveal your weaknesses. That's when our weaknesses are exposed. And sometimes that's the reason for the conflict. As we observed in a previous lesson in this series about what godly people do, godly people endure tribulation. They endure tribulation, trials, difficulties. We will consider other things which godly people do in times of conflict with others. Like I said, we'll save that for a second lesson. This morning, I want us to focus in on the reality of conflict as Jesus presented it to us. So go with me to Matthew chapter 5 and verse 9. Matthew chapter 5 and verse 9 says, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God." Perhaps you've never thought about the implication of the value of a peacemaker. There's an implication there. Peacemakers are not needed in the absence of conflict. So if Jesus is saying that peacemakers are blessed, he's acknowledging the reality of conflict. You don't need a peacemaker otherwise. Even the world understands this, that there is going to be conflict. And thus we have things that are called, some would say that's an oxymoron, but it's not, peacemaking forces. Peacemaking forces. That we have armies of men whose purpose is to bring peace. Again, that just doesn't work for some people in their minds. They think that's contradictory. It is not. And the world has acknowledged that. What these forces do is they enter into the arena of conflict. Voluntarily, they go into the arena of conflict with the purpose, the goal of establishing peace. Peacemakers. Okay? So that's the goal. That's their goal. Their goal is not to conquer and plunder, expand borders. It's to bring peace. And once the conflict is over and peace has been reestablished, the peacemaking forces leave because their job is done. If it's been reestablished. And of course, that's always a very iffy proposition. And it's always debatable about whether or not peace has really been reestablished. Peacemakers are blessed by God because they seek to resolve conflicts. Peacemakers don't pretend like conflict doesn't exist. If we were pretending that conflict doesn't exist, then we would also need to pretend that peacemakers don't exist. So peacemakers are acknowledging that there are conflicts. They don't avoid them. They don't ignore them. They acknowledge that they are real. And brethren, that's what we need to do. God has called us to be peacemakers, which means we have to acknowledge that there is conflict. Now you jump down to the next verse, verse 10. "Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you." So from Jesus' perspective, the reality of conflict is further acknowledged by persecution. That Jesus blesses those persecuted for the sake of righteousness makes it clear that we are not to avoid conflict by compromising righteousness. We are to be righteous, whether or not that brings with it conflict. And Jesus is predicting, acknowledging that righteousness will bring conflict, will put us into conflict with those who are unrighteous. Notice how godly people are to react to it, to the persecution. What is... Again, we'll explore how godly people should respond to conflict more thoroughly in the next lesson that I have. But just while we're here, how are godly people supposed to react in this statement by Jesus? Rejoice and be exceedingly glad. I mean, he could have just stopped with rejoice, right? Because then we could have massaged the word rejoice to think, well, maybe rejoice in some sort of muted way. But he says, and be exceedingly glad. Now, don't misunderstand. Jesus is not saying that having a martyr complex for being countercultural is the goal. That because we've done something that the culture doesn't like, that we derive some sort of perverse satisfaction from suffering at the hands of this unrighteous world. The righteous do not seek the attention of the world. But to be numbered by God with the prophets in enduring the conflicts which inevitably come to those who proclaim God's message is something to be counted as all joy, to borrow from the words of James in James chapter 1 and verse 2. Count it all joy, my brethren, when you fall into various trials. So Jesus, in his beatitudes, his blessings, tells us, by using the word peacemakers and by using the word persecution, that conflict is a reality that comes to those even who are righteous, and maybe even especially to those who are righteous. Now go with me to the 10th chapter of Matthew. Like I said, in this lesson, we are primarily focusing in on Jesus' teaching, which shows that conflict is a reality in this world. In Matthew chapter 10 and verse 34, Jesus says, "Do not think that I came to bring peace on earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I have come to set a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a man's foes will be those of his own household. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." He goes on from there. Jesus bluntly cited the words of the prophet Micah here. Micah chapter 7, verse 6. Micah prophesied against Israel and Judah for their idolatry and their immorality. But he also held out hope for a restoration under the coming Messiah, who would one day come. So it is very interesting that Jesus, the Messiah that Micah prophesied would eventually come, he's ultimately rejected by Israel. Despite the prophecy of Micah that they should look for him and be hopeful for him, they reject Jesus. And so Jesus throws this prophecy back at them, throws Micah back at them, and warns of the same conflict for the Jews of his generation. Jesus makes it clear that his message would lead to conflict, even family strife, and implies that world peace, as is typically envisioned by many, was not his mission. He clearly says that he did not come to bring peace, but a sword. Now, you might notice there, for those of you who are sensitive to these kinds of things, there's this "not but" phraseology used by Jesus here. And usually what that means, often what that means, is that he's giving emphasis to the latter while not absolutely negating the former. Jesus is not saying that he's against any kind of peace whatsoever and that he is for conflict, but that he knew the truth that he came to reveal and establish would divide even the closest of relationships, like mother, father, child relationship, husband-wife relationship. So in this context, Jesus is emphasizing the reality. What he's emphasizing is the reality of the conflict between good and evil, between truth and error, between him and the world. That's what he's emphasizing. That's why he phrases it this way. After reading this, after reading what we read in Matthew chapter 5 in the Sermon on the Mount, the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, blessed are the peacemakers, and now reading, do not think that I came to bring peace on earth. I did not come to bring peace but a sword. Some people would be inclined to go, okay, which is it? Blessed are the peacemakers, or you came to bring a sword and not peace? Are we to be peacemakers, or are we to be followers of the one who said he did not come to bring peace? Which is it? Are we to be peacemakers, or are we to be followers of the one who said he did not come to bring peace? Yes. Yes is the right answer. You might go, oh, my brain doesn't do that. Yes is not the answer. I set it up as an either-or question, which is a lot of times what we do. We create false dilemmas so that it's convenient for us in our thinking. But this is not the way we should be thinking. These are not mutually exclusive, though on the surface, to the worldly, they may appear to be so. If we understand the gospel of Jesus Christ to ultimately be a message of peace to those with ears to hear, it's a message of peace who want peace with God. But if you don't have ears to hear, guess what there's going to be? Conflict. To those without ears to hear, the gospel will mean more conflict in an already conflicted world because of the inevitable fight which must first ensue in order to bring true peace versus worldly peace. Even in worldly peace, we see that sometimes we've just got to send an army in there to get things settled down so that peace can be established. If we can see that in physical things, then why can't we see it in spiritual things? If a doctor tells you that he did not come to make you feel good, but to attack the wound or the cancer or whatever it is that it's ailing you, you don't think that his entire goal isn't to make you feel better, ultimately. But there might be some pain that needs to take place before there can be healing. And that's what Jesus is telling us. Now, let's go over to Luke chapter 14. Luke chapter 14, beginning with verse 25. And great multitudes went with Jesus, and he turned and said to them, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. And whoever does not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. For which of you, intending to build a tower, does not sit down first and count the cost, whether he has enough to finish it? Lest after he has laid the foundation and is not able to finish it, all who see it begin to mock him, saying, this man began to build and was not able to finish. That's illustration number one. Illustration number two begins with verse 31. Or what king, going to make war against another king, does not sit down first and consider whether he is able with 10,000 to meet him who comes against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is still a way off, he sends a delegation and asks conditions of peace. So likewise, whoever of you does not forsake all that he has cannot be my disciple. These are hard words. Not hard so much to understand, but to apply seriously. The standard for discipleship, as far as Jesus is concerned, as Jesus defines things for us here, the standard for discipleship requires us to love Jesus and the truth to which he bore witness more than any other human relationship. And that, brethren, will be intolerable for most people. Not going to happen. Not going to do it. And what does Jesus say? Cannot be my disciple. And so people will reject Jesus. And what will that result in? Conflict. The concept that he introduces here of bearing one's own cross was itself a testimony to the reality of the degree of conflict one would face in becoming a follower of Jesus. Now remember, when Jesus says this, he's not gone to the cross. He's not died on the cross. We look back at this statement with the picture of the cross, and we tend to kind of run those together. But the people that he was talking to did not have that advantage. And to them, when he talks about bearing a cross, that's the last thing anybody on earth would ever want to do. One, it meant you were guilty of something awful. And it was tortuous. It was the epitome of conflict and really of having lost the conflict. Of course, it takes on a whole lot more meaning now that Jesus himself did exactly what he said we would have to do if we are going to be a follower of him. He didn't ask us to do anything that he wasn't willing himself to do, even literally. And we usually talk about bearing a cross in a figurative sense. And then he has these two parables that follow these statements, that if we don't hate father and mother, we cannot be his disciple. If we don't bear our own cross, then we can't be his disciple. And so a lot of people are going to say, yeah, well, then I'm not going to be your disciple then. And that's going to inevitably lead to conflict. But before people jump to that conclusion, that he gives two parables, which compel the listener to consider the cost of following Jesus. Or may I suggest, the cost of not following Jesus. You see, in the material realm, successful people count the cost before investing in any venture, if for no other reason than to avoid the mockery of men due to one's failure to plan adequately. And we have monuments to things that have been begun and stopped right in the middle. And there they stand for sometimes decades before someone finally says, tear it down, because it could just never finish. And of course, when the government's involved, we laugh at it. When we're involved, not so much. But people oftentimes fail to finish what they have started. And Jesus is giving full disclosure that following him will be costly in conflict. Not hiding anything in small print. You follow me, it's going to be costly in conflict. There will be conflict with family, and there will be bearing a cross. Is that too expensive? So some people would say, yeah, okay, thanks for sharing that, Jesus. Being up front, I've got to love you more than my fleshly family. I got to love you who I can't see more than those that I can see. And I've got to bear a cross. Yeah. Told me to count the cost. I've counted the cost. Not in. That's why he gives the second parable. Lest we decline to follow Jesus, failing to fully count the cost of not following him. He offers the second parable of two kings in carnal conflict with one another. If one king counts the armies and determines he cannot win, he wisely sues for peace, is what Jesus illustrates there. And I want to suggest to you that with that illustration, he's telling us it's too costly not to follow Jesus. So if one does not surrender all that he has to King Jesus, not only can he not be Jesus' disciple, but he has failed to count the cost of not being a disciple and will face not only conflict, but defeat. You will lose because you did not count the cost. You have to forsake all, or you cannot be my disciple, is what Jesus says. You have to surrender all, is what Jesus says. And if you don't, you will be defeated. There is no avoiding conflict, is one thing that we can learn from this. Either we join the peacekeeping force of Jesus, or we resist it to our own demise. Count the cost. Admittedly, this either-or requirement to choose a side, Jesus or not Jesus, miffs many people. And they imagine that they can be neutral. Neutral. Neither for or against either side. We're going to stay neutral in this conflict. And don't get me wrong, there may be a place for neutrality in the midst of some human conflicts about which we do not have sufficient information or sufficient interest. However, Jesus' whole purpose in coming was to identify the reality of conflict between good and evil and its consequences. And in defeating evil and death, bring redemption and rescue. And you can't be neutral in that. When it comes to Jesus' mission, there is no neutrality. We are either with him or we are against him, as far as he is concerned. Now, one other gospel that I want us to turn to is John, and look at a few passages there as we wrap things up this morning. In John chapter 16 and verse 33, again, remember our purpose this morning is to see how Jesus acknowledged the reality of conflict. And that's therefore what godly people are going to do. Verse 33 of John 16 says, "These things I have spoken to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world, you will have tribulation. You see that? In the world, you will have tribulation. Perhaps Jesus' clearest words about the reality of conflict come just before he dies on the cross. Just before he experiences conflict in the most significant way. And Jesus had already warned his disciples about inevitable conflict with the world. If you back up to chapter 15 and verse 18, Jesus told his disciples, "If the world hates you, you know that it hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love its own. Yet because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. Remember the word that I said to you? A servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. If they kept my word, they will keep yours also." Jesus spoke these things to them to warn them. But going back to chapter 16, verse 33, he says, "I've spoken them to you that in me you may have peace." Where's peace located? In Jesus. But he contrasted that with the conflict that they would have, the real conflict, the reality of conflict that they would have in this present world. Now, how should the godly respond to the inevitability of conflict? What is our response going to be? And like I said already, I'm going to save most of this for another lesson as far as what our response should be. But go with me real quickly to chapter 18 and verse 10. Remember, I said all these words that Jesus is speaking here in John are just before his death on the cross, a day before his death on the cross. The betrayal takes place that night. Chapter 18 and verse 10. Judas has brought the crowd there. They're arresting Jesus. Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. And Jesus said to Peter, "Put your sword into the sheath. Shall I not drink the cup which my Father has given me?" How should the godly respond to the inevitable conflict that comes with following Jesus? Like Peter on this occasion? No, not like Peter on this occasion. In fact, Jesus rebuked Peter, not only telling him to sheathe his sword, as we just read here, but observing at the same time, as you can read in the Gospel of Matthew, that those who live by the sword will die by the sword. But Jesus said, "I have not come to bring peace, but a sword." We read that earlier, right? But here he tells Peter, who takes his sword and uses it to defend Jesus, that he'd done the wrong thing. Obviously, Peter's response to conflict was not in harmony with what Jesus meant when he said, "I have come to bring a sword." Later, when Jesus was on trial and Pilate cross-examines him, inquires whether or not Jesus was a king, note what he said in verse 36. Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight so that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But my kingdom is not from here." What would they do if his kingdom was of this world? They would fight just like Peter was ready to fight. And I want to suggest to you that with the possible exception of Judas, they were all ready to fight and lay down their lives for their Lord Jesus Christ and the establishment of his kingdom. They were brave. They were courageous by our definitions of those terms. And Jesus said to Peter, sheathe your sword. No wonder they all ran and fled and abandoned Jesus. They were confused. And so just as Jesus' kingdom is not of this world, neither is our response to conflict of this world. Conflict we're going to face, but we are not going to respond to it like the world responds to it. Jesus came with the sword to engage the conflict, but our special weapons and tactics are not of this world. Now back there in chapter 16 and verse 33, I didn't finish reading that. Did you notice that? These things I have spoken to you that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation. But be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. Oh, does that sound a little bit like when we were reading in the Sermon on the Mount, blessed are those who are persecuted. Rejoice, he told them there. What does Jesus say here? Be of good cheer. Why? Jesus has overcome the world. Jesus has overcome the world, and nothing demonstrated his conquest and overcoming of the world better than his death, burial, and resurrection. And to the world, that's nonsense. And maybe even to us, sometimes it's a little bit confusing. But it's clear that Jesus, in allowing himself to die for the cause, gave himself the opportunity to defeat death. And that's why we've gathered together on this first day of the week. To remember the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. His overcoming the world. He came that we might have peace. But in this world, what will we have? Conflict. Tribulation. Be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. And we're remembering that together this morning. We'll do that after we sing number 233.